great blessing and privilege to be with you this day. I would ask you to pray for us what time we stand before you. I will apologize in advance if my voice modulates around. My ears are partially stopped up, and when that happens, you don't know how loud or quiet you are. So if my voice really goes up and down, I'm sorry. I cannot tell how loud or quiet I am right now. Would also ask you to pray for us. I have a desire today to take on something that was requested of me some weeks or months back. And I'll begin in Job 14. And while you're flipping over there to that, I was asked to address in preaching the idea of having an appointed time to die. Now, preaching should not be done strictly from the negative. It should not be a whole sermon of what things are not. Paul told Titus to affirm these things constantly, which means that preaching should be done more from the affirmative rather than the negative. And I've told people before, when someone asks you what you believe, it's always best to start with what we do have and not start with what we don't have. If you spend a bunch of time telling folks, well, we don't have this, we don't have this, and we don't have this, you haven't really told anybody, and I'm guilty of this, we really haven't told anybody what we have. We just told people what we're not about, what we are about. So this morning, I would like to hopefully take on this subject in conjunction with some other things, but I don't want this to be a negative sermon. In other words, just completely taking apart the idea of an appointed time to die. But I'll cut to the chase. The Bible does not teach that there is a predetermined appointed time to die for all of God's people. That's a very common belief today. And if you want something to seem like the truth, just get enough people saying the same thing for long enough and people will just start just assuming that it's the truth. Most Christians today that I run into just assume that this is the truth. Well, we all have a time to die. Can't change it. There's just a time that we're all going to leave this earth. In Job 14, in the 14th verse, Job says this. He says, all the days of my appointed time will I await till my change come. In this verse, the inference can be made by some, and I'm sure has, that Job referenced that we have an appointed time here on this earth. He says earlier in Job 7 and 1, he says, is there not an appointed time to man upon the earth? Now, both of these two verses, that's not what they're teaching. But let's think for a moment just of the logical implications of all of us having a preset, predetermined time to die when we come into this world. If when I was born 39 and a half years ago, if at that moment nothing could change or stop or extend or cut short my time here on this earth, quick question, why pray for anybody? Think about it. If somebody's sick, why would you pray for them? If it's their time, it's their time. If it's not, it's not. Right? How could you ever punish a murderer? All he was doing was executing somebody's time. Right? How could you punish that? I mean, when you just stand it up on logic, it doesn't make sense. But I'm happy to tell you that God has, in His mercy, extended people's lives. And God, in His mercy, has cut short people's lives. And in judgment, He does the same thing. The Bible teaches very clearly that you and I, as we go through life, should and should want to pray for one another. Because by praying for one another, we execute what I think is one of the strongest defenses we have in this world. You know, a lot of times we go through life, and especially if it's something that we're very familiar with, if you're a person who works and your job is very similar from day to day, you get to where you can do it without thinking about it. I get to where I can drive from my house to the base without thinking about it. It's scary sometimes whenever you realize, you just look around and you're like, I don't remember anything about my drive, but here I am at work. I mean, it just becomes that familiar. And when things become familiar, we have a tendency maybe to say, well, I'll just go and do it. I've done it before. Prayer is very necessary. Because, friends, our life can end just like that. Our life is here but a moment and then it's gone. James says it's like a vapor that ariseth and the sun burns it away. The Bible talks about, or David says, that there's but a step between him and death. But the thing that we should care about and praying for one another is that we all need to bow in submission. As David says in Psalm 31 and 15, he said, "My times are in thy hand." He said, "Deliver me therefore, O God, from my enemies." David says, "I bow in submission to the fact that my life is bound up in thy hand, that it's nothing too hard for thee, it's nothing outside thy control." And friends, when you and I have a loved one who is sick, when you and I have a loved one who may be seemingly at death's door, and we pray for the deliverance of that loved one, I'm here to tell you that whether that prayer is answered the way we think it should be or the way we want it to be, the Lord hears and the Lord answers prayer. I am a living testimony right now today that prayer is effective. My dear mother and my father prayed for me while I was growing up. I'm convinced if it wasn't for prayers like theirs and prayers like others of God's people, I would not still be standing here today. Because my time's in the Lord's hands. I should have been gone a long time ago. It's of the Lord's mercies that I have not been cut down already. I had some wild days in my youth. I had some times that I'd rather not think about. I certainly don't want to tell you all the details about them. But friends, by just natural standards, by just logic, I should not be here. I've done some very, there's just no other word for it. I know my wife doesn't want me to use this word in the pulpit, but I did some stupid things when I was young. I continue sometimes to do stupid things. But friends, it's through prayers of God's people that lives can be extended. And you and I don't need to shirk actually praying for ourselves. You know, there was a time when Hezekiah was sick unto death. This is in Isaiah 38. Isaiah was sick unto death, and the Lord basically gives him this proclamation. He says, "Set your affairs in order. Set your house in order, because you're going to die. You're sick, and you're going to die." Immediately, Hezekiah turns his face to the wall and begins to pray. And in praying, he prays that the Lord would deliver him, that the Lord would extend his life. And before Isaiah even gets out of the palace, before he even gets out to his own house, the Lord turns him back around, sends him back to the king, and says, "Tell King Hezekiah, I have seen your prayers, I have seen thy tears." He says, "And I'm going to extend unto thy days 15 years. Friends, if Hezekiah had not prayed, what would have been the end result of that? He would have died. The Lord said he would have died, according to the mouth of the prophet. But by praying, the Lord extended his life 15 years in his mercy. The Lord at other times cuts people down in his mercy to us and his judgment towards them. King David writes in Psalm 55, last verse of that psalm, verse 23, he says, "Bloody and deceitful men will not live out half their days." In other words, there was a time that they could have lived. Naturally speaking, they had the strength to live. But their lives were cut short. They were cut down by their lifestyle and by their decision. Let me ask you a question. Go talk to any random person that you know who is a devout Christian or an avowed Christian and ask them, "Do you believe that someone has an appointed time to die?" And if they say yes, ask them this question. "Do you still look both ways before you cross the street?" I'm going to tell you, I do. There are some lifestyle habits that are in our best interest. If you don't believe looking both ways before you cross the street is in your best interest, just keep playing that game. One day it ain't going to work out. But I'm going to keep looking both ways before I cross the street. You know, before I pull out on a busy highway, I'm going to look to make sure there's no cars coming before I pull out. Those are in our best interest because our certain lifestyle choices can make a major impact on how our lives go. Children, listen up. There are decisions that you make today that can impact you for the rest of your life. There are consequences to what we do. And when somebody is a bloody man, when somebody is a deceitful man, when their lifestyle is engaged in murder, when their lifestyle is engaged in conning their fellow man, there comes a time when their luck runs out, as they say. There comes a time when they're either met by the bar of justice, they're met with revenge from somebody that they have done wrong, and their life is cut down. Maybe they're murdered, maybe they're executed by the law, but either way, they had the ability, naturally speaking, to keep on living, but their life was cut short by the life that they lived. So I hope that I have proven that both ways, you and I can either extend our lives by the mercy of God through prayer, and sometimes our lives can be cut short by our wickedness and by our wicked lifestyle. So what does it mean when Job says, "All the days of my appointed time
will I await till my change come? What does it mean when he says there is an appointed time to man upon the earth? What that simply means, as far as I understand Scriptures to teach, is that because our times are in His hand, because we answer to Him as our Creator, as all men do, there are some things that God has allowed, and there are some things that God has not. If you go back to the very beginning, in the Garden of Eden, when the Lord had man and woman in a paradise, when He gave them all the trees of the garden to freely eat, but one tree, the tree of the knowledge of good and evil, they could not eat of it, for in the day they ate thereof they would surely die. What happened when Adam and Eve ate that tree? Several things happened. One, they died. Second, they realized they were naked. Third, something else had to die to cover their nakedness. Fourth, God cursed man to eat bread by the sweat of his face. Five, He cursed the snake to slither on the ground on the dust. Six, He cursed the woman to have pain and sorrow and conception. And seven, He cursed the earth to produce thorns and weeds and thistles that the man would have to labor for all these things. But after all these curses, after all these things that transpired, the Lord said within Himself, in the Godhead, the Trinity said, man has put forth his hand to eat of the tree of the knowledge of good and evil. And now, lest he put forth his hand and eat of the tree of life and live forever, the Lord within Himself decreed that man should be cast out of the garden, and a cherubim with a flaming sword that turned every way would mark and guard the tree of life so that man could not eat of the tree of life and live forever. What happened from that moment going forward? God limited man's life and man's bounds here upon the earth. In Deuteronomy 32, starting in about verse 9, it says this. It says, for the Lord's portion is His people, Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. I actually need to back up to verse 7. In verse 7, He says, remember the former things of old. Ask thy father and he will tell thee, thy elders and they will show thee, when the Most High divided to the nations their inheritance and separated the sons of Adam and set the bounds of their habitation. For the Lord's portion is His people. Jacob is the lot of His inheritance. He found him in a desert land, in a waste howling wilderness, but He led him about. He instructed him. He kept him as the apple of His eye. You and I, like Jacob, we were separated out from the bounds of the sons of Adam. We were separated out, and we are a chosen race and a chosen nation unto God. But the Lord has also set the bounds of our habitation. You know, I get tickled when I think about all these grand future plans that people have. You know, they've got these ideas that men are going to live on Mars one day. I'll just go ahead and give you my opinion. I ain't got Bible for this, but it's my opinion. It ain't never going to happen. I don't think people are ever going to live on the moon. You know why that is? The Lord has set the bounds of man's habitation. If you and I are going to leave this earth and survive, what we have to do is we have to take enough of this earth with us to survive. Whether it's oxygen, whether it's food, whatever it is, there is not another inhabitable place in this universe because God set this as the place for us to inhabit. Now, I'm not opposed to going to space. Please don't say, Brother Phillips, anti-NASA. I'm not. Although sometimes I wonder if our tax dollars couldn't be spent in a better way. No amens, please. Moving on. All right. So it is part of the bounds of our habitation that the earth is this place that the Lord has put as our home, naturally speaking. But also the Lord has set the bounds of our habitation that you and I aren't going to live here forever. You and I are not going to be here all the time. There is a sense in which you can see where man's bounds have ebbed and flowed over the years. Prior to the flood, man's bounds may have reached 800-900 years, almost 1,000. That's not an allegory, that's literary fact. But after the flood, man's days and his bounds were cut short. They were cut short, and you see men start to live shorter and shorter lives until finally Moses comes along. And Moses coming along was a man who actually lived 120 years. Just as a side note, I believe Moses had the ability to live a whole lot longer than 120 years. Because it says that when he died, his eyesight was not dim and his natural force was not abated. You know what that means? As 120 years old, he could still see. He didn't need glasses. And he still had strength. He could still work. He was still like a man much younger than him. Now, I got a question. Do any of you expect to be 120 years old, not wearing glasses, having the strength of a 40-year-old? I don't. I'll be lucky to make 120. I'll be lucky to make 80. I'll be lucky to make 60. Genetics are not on my side. But think about that. Moses was 120. Brother Ronald said, I don't know if it was Friday night or yesterday morning at Bay Springs, it was one of the two services, that Moses was called by God to go to Egypt when he was 80. So Brother Ronald equated that to the prime of his life. He said, I hadn't reached my prime yet. I'm going to go ahead and tell you, if 80 is the prime, whoo, because I've already passed, I think, what was my prime. Anyway, so let's just think about this. Moses going really to work for the first time in the Lord's service at 80 years old, 40 years later, has all his natural strength, has all his natural eyesight, but he dies. Why was that? Because his days were cut short because of disobedience to God. The Lord told him, you're not going to go into Canaan's land. You're not going to go in because you did not sanctify me at the waters or at the rock of strife. Whenever he told Moses in Numbers 20 to go and speak to the rock, and Moses whacked it twice, he says, you're not going to go in because of this disobedience. Now, what that tells me is, had Moses not hit that rock, had Moses done what he was supposed to do, and all the indication is there that he still had strength to go on, Moses would have lived long enough to go into Canaan's land. But this man, who lived 120 years and could have lived longer, this man who had great strength as an old man, he writes in Psalm 90, in verse 10, he says that the days of the years of our pilgrimage are 70, and if by reason of strength they be 80, yet is their strength labor and sorrow, for we are soon cut off and we fly away. In this verse, Moses tells us that the natural average bound of our habitation is between 70 and 80 years. Still holding true, ain't it? You know, think about somebody who lives what we consider a full life. A full life is considered about 80 or so. People, when they die at 70, folks don't say, glad they're gone. But folks mostly look at it like, well, they lived a good life. They were old. They lived a good life. If you're 70 or 80, please don't be offended. I called you old. To a 39-year-old, you're older than I am. Anyway, but you think about what Moses said. He said, this is our bound, between 70, 80 years. Naturally speaking, that's the average. Some men live longer, some men live shorter, but there it is. There is the natural average bound. So whatever our life is, whether it's 40, whether it's 50, 60, 70, 80, 90, 100, doesn't really matter. It fits within this framework that the Lord has established and set the bounds of our habitation. You say, why are you drawing on that? The reason I'm drawing on that is because notice what Job said. He said, all the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. Here's where I really want to focus and not just dwell on whether there's a time to die or not. I hope we've established that there's not. Think about what Job is saying. He's saying, I understand because there's an appointed time to man upon the earth, and because there's an appointed time to me, he's saying, I understand I am not here forever. I understand that it's not in me, it's not in my constitution to live here forever. And it's not in any of our constitution to live here forever. We're not capable of it. But Job says, for what time, when he says all the days of my appointed time, what he's saying is, for what time I'm here, wherever I may be on that spectrum, wherever it may be, whether I live to be young, old, somewhere in between, however long I live, he says, all the days of this time that I have, this time that I have here on this earth, will I wait till my change come? In this passage, a little earlier, talks about the difference between man and things in nature, and the similarity between man and things in nature. And he starts talking about things that happen here in nature. He says in verse 4 of Job 14, he says, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean thing? Then he answers his own question. He says, not one. And naturally speaking, that does not work. You know, if I was to take this cup, refill it with water, stick one little drop of poison in it, and say, here you go, drink some of this water. It's only got a little bit of poison in it. Do I have any takers? No, because once something unclean goes in it, the whole thing becomes unclean, right? My wife and I had a discussion when we first got married about what constituted clean clothes. We never arrived at a consensus on that. Because in my opinion, if it looked decent, smelled decent most of all, it was clean. Women, that's just how men are. If it looks all right, and most important, if it smells all right, we're good. And that's why you have to work really hard to make sure we don't leave the house looking lousy. I get it. But my wife's thought was, if it's got a spot on it, if it's got a wrinkle on it, if it's got any problem whatsoever, it's just not clean. She's probably more right than I am, I'll admit that. Because friends, if you look at somebody and their shirt is 99% clean, and you see one little spot on there, what is it you're going to focus on? You're just going to keep staring at that spot, like it's just going to go away by looking at it, right? Read about an exercise that psychologists gave people where they took a piece of paper, put a little dot in the middle of the paper, and asked people to describe, write down for 5 minutes what they saw. People wrote down the color of the dot, the size of the dot, the shape of the dot, where it was situated on the page. That was all they talked about. And the conclusion they reached was that even though the overwhelming majority of that paper was a clean white sheet, all anybody described was the dot. Think about how news travels in this world. Someone can be living a good, righteous, godly life. Nobody talks about it. But boy, you let one little thing out in the community. Hey, did you hear about so-and-so? I can't believe he did that. I can't believe she did that. Yeah, let me go tell my friend. June, did you hear what happened to so-and-so? I can't believe he did that, and I can't believe she did. And all of a sudden, before you know it, the whole community knows it. The whole state knows it. As Brother Ronald says, good news won't get around the block before bad news circles the globe. That's just the way it is. So you think about what Job is saying. He says, who can bring a clean thing out of an unclean? Not one. You think about where man is in this world. He says, there's more hope of a tree than there is for man. Because of a tree, when it's cut down, though its roots get old and its stock groweth cold in the ground, yet to the scent of water, it will spring up, it will bud again. He says, but man dieth. And where is he? Man is cut down. And what happens to him? Naturally speaking, when we look here in this world, there is no hope after man dies. There is no hope after man leaves this world, naturally speaking. We can look at nature and see it regenerate, see it reform, rebloom, reblossom, rebud, resprout, all these things. But when somebody dies, to our perspective here on earth, that's it. But Job is saying about himself, he says, all the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. There is a purpose for being here. There's a purpose for my living here, and there's a certain way that I need to go about this. And one of the ways that we go about this is not counting down the days until we check out of this place. The way we live is not mourning all the time we spent not doing what we should have done. You know, there is a sense in which people can live in the past, they can live in the future, and they can live in the present. And there's a certain way all of those can be done wrong, and there's a certain way all of those can be done right. Most people living in the past do it one of two ways. They ever look back and they talk about all their precious memories and the good old days and the glory days, and it just ain't like that anymore. I mean, I used to get so sick and tired of hearing my grandfather's generation talk about the good old days and how great it was, and oh, this pitiful young generation, they just don't know nothing. And finally, I asked Grandpa one time, I said, Grandpa, when you were born, did y'all have electricity? No, we didn't. I said, do you want to go back to that? No. I said, when you were born, did y'all have indoor plumbing? Well, our neighbors did, but we didn't until I was about 5. I said, you want to go back to that? Now, I was insolent in my youth. You think I'm a brat now? I was insolent back then. And I finally got my grandpa to agree that maybe the good old days wasn't so good after all. At least not in all counts. Now, I admit, in a lot of ways, communities were a whole lot better off back then. But friends, you can live in the past thinking about the good old days and the glory days, and it'll make you sad and depressed about today. Some people live in the past with regret, remorse, guilt over all the things that they've done, that they shouldn't have done, they wish they'd have never done, and they just can't ever seem to get past. Those are ways in which a lot of people live in the past, and that's not a good way to live. Some people live in the future, always chasing the next thing. Well, if I can just get this, I'll be happy. if I can just finally get a chance to buy this, I'll be set. I get tickled listening to my children because they say the same kind of things that I used to say. I heard one of them make a deal with another one day before yesterday. I'll try to keep the genders neutral so you won't know, at least have a shot of who this is. One of them told the other one, if you'll do this for me, I'll never ask you for anything again. I thought, boy, wonder how long that's going to last. And you think about deals like that. You think about when people say things like that, they're saying, if I can just get here, I'll be happy. If I can just get this, I'll be satisfied. Let me tell you something, friends. It don't matter what you work for and what you get. There's always going to be something else. There's always going to be something else you want. Because when you finally get what it was you were working so hard to have, then you look at Joe over there and you're like, well, I kind of want that too. So then all of a sudden you forget about what you spent days, months, weeks, or years trying to get. And now you want what Joe's got. It's just the way we are. So some people live in the future thinking about what they could have. Some people live in the future thinking about, well, I'm just worried about what's going to happen. You know, I just don't know what's coming, but it's probably going to be bad. You know, a lot of times the things we worry about are the things that never end up happening anyway. It's been my experience. The things that I worry about, most of them generally don't happen. You know, we're not supposed to take thought for tomorrow. We should take thought for today. For tomorrow should take care of itself. Sufficient unto the day is the evil thereof, our Lord says in the Sermon on the Mount, Matthew 6. So, we can spend our time thinking about the future, worrying about it. Spend our time thinking about the future, wanting something. But neither one of those helps. And then some people live in the present, just living for the right now. That's where most of our culture is, isn't it? What have you done for me lately? What can you do for me now? What can I have right now? I about decided we're all programmed to have a commercial break about every 5 minutes. About the way we are. We need a break, and we want something right now. Those are ways you can live in the past, present, and future in a bad way. But there's a sense in which we all should live in the past, present, and the future. How should you and I live in the past? We should learn lessons as we go along. That when you look back and you see mistakes you've made, it's not to have guilt about. It's not to feel the continual shame that you just can't ever get past. It's to look back and say, how can I do better so I don't do that again? You know, one of the things that was a rough day in our house growing up is when you made the second mistake of the same offense. Because what happened? It wasn't that you didn't know. It's not that you didn't know what the punishment was. It was, weren't we just here yesterday over this very same thing? And then you heard those dreaded words. Those dreaded words for me. Son, you knew better than this. It was going to be bad after that. If the spanking was prefaced, son, you knew better than this, it was just going to be bad. The problem was I hadn't learned lessons from the past. The past is for us to learn lessons from. The past is for us to appreciate looking back where the Lord has led us and how the Lord has guided us and how the Lord has given us strength. That's how you and I are to live in the past, thinking about the wonderful mercies of God and learning the lessons we ought to live. The way we look forward, the way we live in the present is we look at every day as a gift and every day as a way to wake up and to serve the Lord all over again. The psalmist says in Psalm 124, this is the day that the Lord hath made. We will rejoice and be glad in it. The day that we live in is not a day for complaining. The day we live in is not a day for worrying. The day we live in is not a day for having strife and conflict all over the place. The day we live in is not for being wrought up all the time. The day we live in is for serving the Lord and being glad in the day that He's given unto us. Because when you woke up this morning, the Lord had given you a fresh, brand new day. The Lord had given you a fresh set of mercies that are new every morning, and the Lord's promises from yesterday are still true today, that He goes with us, He guides us, He directs us, He'll never leave us nor forsake us, and His Spirit still dwells in tabernacles with the children of men. That is still present today. And it's not about what I can get today, it's not about what I can get right now, it's about what I can do and serve Him in this day that He's given unto me. And the way that you and I look forward to the future or live in the future is we look forward to the ways in which the Lord is going to be with us, the ways the Lord is going to bless us, and most importantly, that ultimate day when the Lord comes and that great change comes and we are able to see Him as He is and be satisfied when we awake with His likeness, when we can see Him in all of His glory and all the holy angels with Him and our eyes behold for the very first time the Lord in whom we love. That great change that Job said he was waiting for, he says, that is how I'm going to spend my appointed days. That is how I'm going to spend the time of life that I have here on this earth. Job wasn't trying to indicate that we have a set time, but he was saying that whatever my time is, whatever my days are here on this earth, may I be looking and waiting and expecting and hoping for that great change and for that great day when the Lord is going to come and to call us home. Whenever David said, my times are in thy hand, David understood that in a very real, in a very personal way. David had at that point been delivered time and time again from Saul. David had been delivered time and time again from his enemies. The Lord protected him when he kept his father's sheep. The Lord protected him when he went out against the giant. The Lord protected him when the king and his army sought his life. The Lord protected him when he was in strange places and in strange lands. And friends, may I tell you today that your times are still in His hands. The Lord watches over you, and the Lord protects you in this strange land that we live in. He protects you when you're amongst your enemies. He sometimes prepares a table before you in the presence of your enemies. But in all these things, friends, may we look to Him, understanding that whatever time we have here on this earth, it belongs to Him. It's not mine. It belongs to Him. My appointed time and my times, they're in His hand. It's not mine to do with as I please. They're His for me to honor Him for the time that He's given me here. I tell you, friends, the more we can focus on what's His and the less of what's ours, a whole lot better off we're going to be. Because you know, there are things that we think of as ours. There's things that we think of belong to us. But friends, ask yourselves, what really belongs to us? Answers, nothing. Psalmist says in Psalm 24:1, the earth is the Lord's and the fullness thereof. Everything here belongs to Him. I would like to think that in another, you're going to be 17 when this happens, because we're trying to get this done before you graduate, so we'll have money to pay for your college. Anyway, so you're 13 now. All right. So, Lord willing, 4 years from now, if all goes according to plan, the house that I live in will be mine. The bank still owns a good portion of it, but in 4 years, if all goes according to plan, it'll be mine. Is that true? What happens if I don't pay my taxes? It's no longer mine. So in a sense, you could say it belongs to the government. But in an even greater sense, it belongs to the King. I sometimes talk about my life. I sometimes talk about my wife. I sometimes talk about my family. Is it really mine? Paul says in 2 Corinthians 7:1, he says, therefore glorify the Lord in your body and in your spirit, which are the Lord's. I'm not even my own. I'm bought with a price. My wife, though she and I are one. Where does it really come from? Solomon says, he that findeth a wife findeth a good thing and obtaineth great favor from the Lord. Children that I have are a heritage of the Lord. The church that the Lord has blessed me to dwell in belongs to Him. Friends, these things are not ours, they're His. And the more we can focus on things belonging to Him and less of it belonging to us, the better off we're going to be. Because consider where Job is at this moment. Put yourself in Job's shoes. At this moment, he has lost all of his children. He's lost all his possessions. He's broke. He's lost his health. He's got boils from the crown of his head to the sole of his feet. His wife doesn't even want to talk to him anymore. He says later in Job 23, I believe, says, my breath is counted strange to my wife. He basically has no respect in the community. The young children that used to respect him now rise up and mock him. And if that wasn't bad enough, he's about halfway through a conversation with three, as he calls them, miserable comforters, who all they've come to do, to what the Bible calls as their friend, that says that Job was their friend, all they came to do was to basically say, Job, obviously you're guilty of something. Obviously you have some secret sin that you need to confess. The Lord has made this plain with this judgment. Just go ahead and confess it and get it out of the way. Which wasn't true, because Job hadn't done any of that. Put yourself in Job's shoes. You've lost everything. Your spouse won't talk to you. Your children are dead. You're in pitiful hell. And people that are supposed to be your friends, all they do is just come and accuse you time and time and time again. How do you respond? This is how Job responded. All the days of my appointed time will I wait till my change come. He goes on later in Job 19, starting in verse 23. He says, "Oh, that my words were now printed in a book, that they were graven with an iron pen and lead in a rock forever." Job says, "I have something worth talking about, something worth putting down, something worth standing and enduring for generations to come." And what was it Job wanted to talk about? Was it about how pitiful his life had been? Was it about how miserable his friends were? Was it about how bad his wife had treated him or how much he missed his children? No, here's what he wanted to talk about. He says, "I know that my Redeemer liveth and that he shall stand at the latter day upon the earth." Job says that even right now, in the midst of my toil, in the midst of this time that I'm living in right now, he says, "I know that my Redeemer liveth." Now, Jesus wasn't going to come upon the scene here in this world for another 1,700 years. It's going to be almost 2 millennia before Jesus arrived walking on the earth. But notice what Job says. He doesn't say, "I know that my Redeemer will live." He says, "My Redeemer liveth." He's alive right now. And you and I can even more than that today say, "I know that my Redeemer liveth," because he's alive right now at his Father's right hand. And Job says he's going to stand upon the earth at the latter day. He did. He came and literally stood upon this earth. And at that day, at the end of that time, at the end of that era, he put away sin by the sacrifice of himself. And that's why Job could go on to say, "And though after my skin worms destroy this body, yet in my flesh shall I see God, whom I'm going to behold with mine eyes and not another's, though my reins be consumed within me." Job was having the most tragic of circumstances, but where was his outlook? Where was his mind focused? What was he thinking about? Was he thinking about what a miserable life he had? Was he thinking about what a terrible thing his friends had done? No, he was thinking about what a great God he had and what a mighty friend he had. That though all nature should decay and come to ruin, though it all should go back to the dust from whence it came, yet there was coming a day when he was going to stand before his God in righteousness and behold him with his very own eyes. I tell you, friends, that no matter today what you see crumbling in this world, no matter the values that you see going away, no matter the spirituality that you see on the decline, no matter the apathy that you see in many, it does not change the fact that our Redeemer is alive. It does not change the fact that there is hope for all those that we've placed in the grave. And it does not change the fact that right now, today, at this present hour, November the 17th, 2019, that you and I should be awaiting for our change to come, looking forward to the day and understanding that nothing is going to keep or prevent the Lord from doing His work and having all of us be with Him in heaven in immortal glory. I tell you, friends, when I think about what the Lord has done, and when I think about what men like Job have said, it makes me want to do as Moses says there in Psalm 90 again in verse 12. He says, "So teach us to number our days that we may apply our hearts unto wisdom." You know, there's two ways in which we fail to number our days and apply our hearts to wisdom. Sometimes we're young and dumb and think, "I've got all the time in the world." You ever heard the old expression, "Youth is wasted on the young"? I'm old enough now, I can say it was wasted on me. When you've got the time and the strength and the energy is when you most waste it, because you feel like you've got all the time in the world. Then when you get old, you say, "I just don't have enough time left." Let me ask you a question. What is it the Lord requires of us? What is it the Lord expects of us? He answers that question. Micah 6:8 says, "He has showed thee, O man, what is good." And what is that? To do justly, to love mercy, and to walk humbly with thy God. What do you need to do that? Right now. That's all you need, is right now to do that. How do you do justly? Right now. You do the best that you can. How do you love mercy? right now. You show kindness and compassion the best way you can to the Lord's people and to His bride. How do you walk humbly with thy God? Every step, may it be the best step that you can take at that moment, at that time, and at that place. Wherever you are in life, friends, wherever you and I may find ourselves in this appointed time that we have, in these bounds in which we dwell in our life here on this earth, whether long or short, may it be doing justly, loving mercy, and walking humbly with our God. We sing a song sometimes called, "Oh, how happy are they who their Savior obey." Last verse of that song says, "Now my remnant of days." I can't even think of the words. Thank you, Brother Caleb. "Now my remnant of days would I spend to His praise, who hath died my poor soul to redeem, whether many or few, all my years are His due. May they all be devoted to Him." Friends, whether you're young or old, you have what you need right now to serve Him. Don't get caught up thinking how much time you have left or how little time you have left. None of us know. None of us are promised tomorrow. All we have is right now. May it be spent in devotion to Him. When I was a young man, I was taught the value and the example of faithfulness to the end by many old saints of God who walked humbly with their God all the days I saw of their life. And for whatever time that I have left, I want it to be spent in faithful devotion to my God so that I can do as we all, I would think, hope to do, that I may finish well. I want to finish well. I want to be like Paul when he says, "I fought a good fight. I finished my course. I've kept the faith." And while I do that, I look forward to that day when my chains come as Job did, understanding that my times are in His hand, and may they all be spent in devotion and praise unto Him. I hope this has been a blessing unto you. I hope that I've spent time affirming these things rather than just speaking in the negative. And if I have, and if you've been blessed by it, may the Lord add His blessings unto you. May we spend our days together looking to Him as the author and the finisher of our faith. And if these things have done that, give Him all the praise, honor, and glory. If I've offended this day in anything that I've said and the way that it's come across, you please lay that to my charge. May the Lord bless you, my friend.